Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so before we start, why don't, if you want to say a few words, Rabbi Kelman, or I will say a few words.
Okay, thank you very much. I just want to welcome everybody to, this is at least, let's say, our sixth or seventh go-around. There's going to be over 70 lectures now on everybody and anybody in the rabbinic world, and I think the lectures are fascinating, and the analysis and enlightening. So I encourage those who are new, if you want to listen to some of the past lectures, and I want to welcome everybody back and welcome everybody new. And know how it works. If you have a question in the middle, you can type in the box. You can afterwards, if you'd like, if you want to speak up, that is fine. And we'll try to get to your questions as you go along. And I just we're always interested in feedback and comments and and spreading the word. And without further ado, Dr. Mark, a pleasure to have you once again, with us to go on really what looks like some interesting, new speakers. And I know you've mentioned the influence of the Ritva's in the past, and now we'll get to him on a systematic way. Okay, take it away. Thanks a lot.
Okay, this is actually, we'll be beginning with the third class on the Ritva's. We'll probably go today and one more class. For those who haven't heard the first two classes, you can get them at 99 cents Canadian. You can watch them either as video or audio for your MP3. If you go to the homepage of the Torah in Motion website, just click on MP3s. You can find it there, as well as the Torah study on Christmas Eve talk, which was the last one. This semester, the plan is to finish up with the Ritva's, do Rabbi Henkin, Eliezer Berkovitz, and maybe start with Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski, although I'm skeptical about that. As always, there's a lot to do, a lot I want to say, respond to comments, which you've sent me. I'm looking at the names. I recognize almost all the names, but in case there's someone new, of course, feel free to send your questions in. At the end, we always have time. At 10 o'clock I stop, but then we'll have time for comments or questions. And I will begin, as I always do, the first for about till about 10 after, either responding to questions and pointing out interesting things that I found that are relevant to what we've done. So let me first begin with a correction. I also like to give the corrections. Those who heard the talks on Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan, we were speaking a good deal about his responsum using non-Jewish music in davening. And I mentioned that there was frumkeit even in Italy. And I quoted Yisrael Moshe Chazan as saying that there were some people who he mentions they go to a simcha, like a wedding, and if someone wants to sing a Jewish song in the vernacular, they get all uptight and say, you can't do this, it has to be in Hebrew. And I actually spoke too quickly. I realized after I mentioned that, though I didn't get a chance to go back to it, he's actually quoting the Rambam. This is actually in the Rambam in his Parish of Mishnah and Masachet Avot, chapter 1, Mishnah 16. It's the Rambam who speaks about in his day you had this sort of frumkeit, which I think is interesting. We have a sense that frumkeit like this is a more modern idea, or it's an Ashkenazic thing. And here the Rambam is talking about, and he calls it utterly foolish, that people in the Rambam's day thought that there was a problem singing a Jewish song if it was in the vernacular. Now, we spoke a good deal about the responsum of Chazan, the Krach Shalromi. I mentioned Rav Avadi Yosef, who really adopts this almost lock, stock, and barrel, that there's no problem using non-Jewish music in davening, even love songs. The only way he disagrees with Yisrael Moshe Chazan is with regard to music, idolatrous, or related to church singing. That, he says, is going too far. We're not going to start taking, he says, Gregorian chants or things like that and using them in our davening, which is exactly what Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan said you could do. Right after that class finished in Tavis of this year, a little article appeared in the Torah journal I get from Israel called Or Torah. This is found on pages 383 and 384, where a rabbi named Eliyahu Bar Shalom, I don't know him. He's identified as a Rosh Kollel and Beit Midrash of Dayanim called Mishpatei Achayim in Jerusalem. He writes a he elaborates on what I just mentioned, and he claims that he was once in a car with Rav Avadi Yosef, coming back from one of these gatherings, Atzeret HaTorah route. When, if you've been in Israel, you've seen all the signs that they put up, calling everyone to come and listen to all these great rabbis to talk. And they were driving back from Bat Yam, that's where his father is a Rav there. Right back from Jerusalem, from Bat Yam to Jerusalem, and he says while they're in the car, the driver takes out a cassette of the songs of Kulthum. Now, if you don't know who Kulthum is, she was a famous Egyptian for 60 years. She was a famous Egyptian female singer. By the time she died, she was the most important and popular female singer, maybe the most important and popular singer in the entire Arab world. So he puts in this tape of Kulthum, and he describes how Rabbi Avadi Yosef puts his head back, and he listens very to the music, and he even starts singing along. And then he goes on, and says he begins speaking to him about, the music, the non-Jewish music. And Rabbi Avadi says to him, if you want to make music, let's say, in the Kaddish, he says, make it only from the songs of Kulthum. That is, you could take the music of Kulthum, and I checked, you can look on YouTube, find plenty of songs from Kulthum, watching, and you can watch her sing. And he says, but not take the songs of Bet Shin. And now that this rabbi doesn't tell us who Bet Shin is, he just tells us that this is a secular Israeli singer in those days, which I assume is about 25 years ago. So I don't know, I'm sure someone here knows who a famous secular Israeli singer Bet Shin is, that Rav Avadia says you can't take Jewish music, that is davening music, from the tunes of Bet Shin. I don't know my Israeli music, I'm sure one of you is going to know who that is, but Kulthum, he says that is fine. Boaz Sharabi, very good, thank you very much. Now, I'm sure many of you are saying, now what's going on here, Kolisha, women singing, all this. I'm just telling you what the Rav tells us here. And truthfully, you didn't need this article that just appeared, because in this book, which he mentioned before, Ben Porat Yosef, one of the two biographies that came out about Rav Avadi Yosef, they also mention this. They mention how Rav Avadia was very much into Arabic music, especially Kulthum, although on page 408, it talks about that when he would listen to Kulthum, he was mocked that when he first heard her music, to say about her, Yimach Shema. May her name be blotted out. I don't know why he would say that. If he liked her music, especially the other report has him saying that her music is good music, good spiritual music. But in any event, I think that's quite interesting. They mention other Arabic music he liked, but since these are by male singers, or a male singer, I didn't think it was that significant. I do want to respond to one more question, although I think it's getting a little late here. Let me just respond to one more thing and then move on, especially because the person who asked me about it is not on. I'll wait till maybe next time about the Brisker method. He wanted to know something about Rav Soloveitchik, so Lachak Man, and I'm going to tell you some interesting things about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and some of his... what he threw out, what in his mind... Well, actually, maybe we will get to that, because we're going to get right into Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. One of you, though, asked me for an example of a pilpul. I mentioned that, and I could send you the reference, that there's one book that deals with an issue, I think it's in Tosos, and he said, we can explain it 50 ways this way or 50 ways that way, and he starts going through it. That I don't think you want to listen to me giving all 50 examples, but... I'm going to tell you an example of what I think is pilpul, although one of you might disagree, and you might not think it's pilpul. But it certainly makes my head go round. And then when we finish with that, we'll move right into the talk. That's interesting you say that, Yossi. I mean, that's a famous viewpoint. Some people say that if the woman's already dead, you know what she looks like, but she's no longer alive, but Rav Avadia certainly knew what Kulthum looked like. He lived in Egypt. Her face was everywhere, so now it's one thing when you go to YouTube, she'll be an old lady. I don't think anyone's going to say there's a problem maybe listening to the old lady, but 60 years ago, she wasn't so old. Getting back to the, let me give you this example, and then I'll leave you to think about this, because as I said, it's hard to wrap my head around this. This is found, I took this out of the journal Or Yitzchak that I mentioned when we did, if you recall, when we did the Satmar Rav, I mentioned that there was another big Rav in the city of Satmar who was part of what we called the status quo community. And he published this journal called Or Yitzchak, called Oel Yitzchak, in which all you have is great rabbis from Poland and Russia and the like, but none of the Hungarian rabbis, because the status quo communities, and we can't go into that now, we spent a lot of time on this, were pretty much regarded as outcasts. But in one of these issues, this actually comes from Sivan of Tafresh Samachet, the following question is stated by this, by Menachem Ratner. He's the Rav of the city of Bremen. And this is the question. We've spoken a good deal about public Sabbath violation, and that, at least according to the Talmudic law, someone who violates Sabbath publicly has the status in certain areas of a non-Jew. We also spoke about how the rabbis say it doesn't apply anymore. But okay, that's the Talmudic position. So he raises a question. What does it mean to violate Shabbos publicly? The Farhesia. It means in front of 10 Jews. So he says, he raises this question. Let's say you have 11 Jews together, 11 of them, and they all violate Shabbos together at one time. What's the law? Is this regarded as violating Shabbos publicly? Because after all, you have one person who violates in front of 10 others. However, the other 10 are also violating Shabbos. So you might want to say that it's not considered Befarhesia, because since all of them are violating Shabbos, then they don't have the status of a Jew, and therefore, if you violate Shabbos in front of them, it's not considered Befarhesia. But then he says, however, if none of them have the status of a Jew, that means that they have this. If none of them have the status, of a non-Jew, that means they all have the status of a Jew. So that means when you violate Shabbos in front of them, it is considered Befarhesia. But how could it be considered Befarhesia? Because every one of them is violating Shabbos in front of the others. So it goes back and forth, and it's very complicated. And this is the exact sort of thing that many rabbis had no patience with and no tolerance with. Okay, let us move on. Rav Yaakov David Wolofsky. I don't have his picture anymore because it was erased, but... I might have this picture here again. I was asked... Yeah, here's the picture I showed you on the screen. I was asked, did he have children? And this is a little book, incidentally. It's called Rinu Yaakov. It's the life of Rav Yaakov David Ridbaz. It really doesn't have anything in this book. It's a short biography with some excerpts from his writings. But it talks about his children. He had two sons. He had two daughters. You can get all the details in here for those who are interested. When we ended last class, I was speaking about the controversy over the Brisker method, that the Ridbaz attacks the Brisker method. And then in this book, Rabbi Albom attacks... attacks the Ridbaz for attacking the Brisker method. And we spoke a good deal about what was the characteristics of the Brisker method, why would he attack it so strongly. Remember what he said, it's better to have a yeshiva without a Rosh Yeshiva than to have a Rosh Yeshiva who practices the chemical method. We spoke about why he thought it was such a distortion of traditional Torah study. And I just want to say, before we go further and continue with Ridbaz's career, a few more words about the Brisker method. Because some number of you asked questions about it. And let me just mention about custom. Custom was another thing. We spoke about different areas where Rav Chaim of Brisk refused to be bound by convention and did his own thing. And I mentioned that Rav Zevin says that that's the reason why he didn't want a Paskin Shilas, why there was a Dayan. Because if he would start deciding Jewish law, you'd come up with all sorts of strange views in opposition to the traditional approach. The same thing was with regard to customs. And it wasn't just Reb Chaim. This goes through the Briskers, all of them. I'm going to give you a couple examples right now. for the Briskers, for Reb Chaim and his sons and his grandson, they had this conception, which as far as I know, no one else had, that minhagim, Jewish customs, need to be placed in some sort of halachic framework. Now, I don't know if this falls in 100% of Professor Chaim Soloveitchik mentioned to me that there were problematic customs which Reb Chaim adopted, or held to. For example, he said Kol Nidre, he read the Torah the night of Simchas Torah, and perhaps the difference is customs which can be put into a halakhic framework and customs which are just are independent of halakha. But let me give you an example of how radical this conception can be. I mean, we mentioned last class the whole idea of fasting, how, at least in theory and perhaps even in practice, the Briskers didn't think that any of the fasts other than Yom Kippur, and this even includes Tisha B'Av, they did not think that they were binding anymore. And I told you the story of how the Brisker Rav on Tisha B'Av, he was eating. That's in the realm of halacha. What about in the realm of minhag? Let me give you an example. One famous one, one not so famous one, Sfira. We all, I said the Brisker Rav on Tisha B'Av. I have to look at my notes again. It might have been Shivasar Batamuz. Actually, I think it was Shivasar Batamuz that he was fasting. But the logic, as quoted by Rav Schechter, applies to Tisha B'Av also. I'm going to speak exactly what Rabbi Hirsch says in a minute, and I quote Rabbi Weinberg says, there's a minhag, which goes back a long way to medieval times, about mourning prohibitions on Sfira. It's not mentioned in the Rambam, but it's certainly an Ashkenazic minhag, it becomes a Sephardic minhag. There is no evidence that this minhag is anything other than rising from the masses, or maybe even from the Torah world, but it never occurred to anyone before the Briskers that this had to be placed in some sort of halacha construct. Now, what does that mean, placed into some sort of halacha construct? Well, what is Sfira all about? It's about mourning, avelos. Well, traditional Judaism, based on Jewish law, knows of different categories of mourning. We all know this. There's Shiva. There's the 30 days after a death, and then there's the 1 year. So if Sfira is a category of mourning, which it is, therefore, according to the Briskers, I shouldn't say according to the Briskers, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, Joseph Baer Soloveitchik, I think this is original to him. I don't think, he doesn't quote this in the name of his father or grandfather, but it shows you how the creativity of the Briskers goes on. Therefore, it has to fall into one of the categories. What type of, it's clearly not Shiva, and it's also not Shloshim. The things we do during Sfira don't correspond to the practices of Shloshim, of the 30 days of mourning. Therefore, it must be Yud Beis Chodesh, 12 months. And since Yud Beis Chodesh, during 12 months, we shave every day, the people are accustomed to shave every day, therefore, there's no problem shaving during Sfira. And this is applied halacha l'maisa, for practical terms, by Rabbi Soloveitchik, and everyone relies on this, and they shave during Sfira. And yet, whoever said that the law, the practices of Sfira have to fall into halacha categories? The fact is that people had a practice, a custom, a minhag, not to shave during Sfira, and they never thought whatsoever about halacha categories. They had a minhag. Some minhag even come from the people. However, Rav Soloveitchik, from his perspective, the minhag has no validity unless it's placed into a halacha category. And therefore, it has to be placed into 12 months, and therefore, no problem shaving. But this is a complete overturning of what Jews had done for hundreds of years. But that's what Briskers do. Could be, but I've seen a lot of sources about this, and I've never, including this text that quote the Rav, and they never quote him as saying this anywhere. Rav Schechter and Nefesh HaRav refers, if I'm not mistaken, it's Nefesh HaRav, or maybe someone else, referred to a Kaf HaChayim, and I looked high and low and couldn't find it anywhere in a Kaf HaChayim. But maybe there is something there, but I guarantee you, Rabbi Soloveitchik did not know the Kaf HaChayim, if there's anything like it. But let me give you a better one. And this is also found in Nefesh HaRav, and I'll tell you some Torah Shavata also. And you can find it in Rabbi Koenigsberg's book about Shirei HaRav, about Avelos. And this comes from Rav Chaim's son, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. This is found, if you want to check it, page 20 in this book in the back, the second pagination, and it's found in Nefesh HaRav, on page 198. What's the issue? This deals with bathing during the 3 weeks. Bathing during the 3 weeks itself is a very interesting thing. As far as I know, all the standard post-scheme today say that there's no problem bathing, even in warm water, because it's something that everyone does. They're used to doing it, and it's not something special. It's not like in the olden days where this would be something out of the ordinary. You know, the idea of taking a warm bath in medieval times was, or even, well, I guess relatively recently, was a big deal. And yet, I've still seen in many shuls these rabbis hand out these pages which talk about how you're not supposed to bathe, and I don't think there's one person in the shul that pays attention to that, and yet they pass them out, and I'm sure the rabbis don't pay attention to that. But that's not the issue. Let's assume that all bathing is not permissible. Where does this come from? Well, the Shulchan Aruch says the practice is yesh noagim, not to bathe from Rosh Chodesh until Tisha B'Av. I'm talking about the 9 days here, not the 3 weeks. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik explains that according to Halacha, we know, again, this whole idea of avelos, putting everything into the categories, according to Halacha, there's no iser, there's no prohibition to wash for an avel, except during Shiva. During 30 days, there's no problem. However, already the Ramah mentions that the minhag, the practice, is not to have real bathing, that is bathing for pleasure, not bathing for cleanliness, all 30 days. And therefore, Rav Moshe says, since Ashkenazi, during the 9 days, they follow the categories of mourning of 30 days, that is of when someone dies, 30 days. Therefore, from Rosh Chodesh Av until the fast day, you also don't wash. Okay, makes sense. We don't wash for pleasure in the 30 days after a death, and therefore, since the 9 days before Tisha B'Av is like the 30 days, we don't wash also. But Rav Moshe Soloveitchik says, since in today's day and age, today, we are not accustomed, we're not nohag, to refrain from washing for an avel, for a mourner during the 30 days. By the way, thank God I've never been an avel. And you can tell me, I'm sure many people here have been an avel. Is that true, that the practice is that we don't bathe the 30 days? But Rav Moshe says, he's reflecting his era, his time, he says that we've gone back to the original practice of which is only during the Shiva we don't bathe, not during 30 days. Remember, that was a separate minhag that Jews took upon themselves. But Rav Moshe says, today we're not accustomed to do that. Therefore, there is no reason not to bathe during the 9 days. The only time you don't bathe is on Tisha B'Av. And Rav Shechter mentions the same svara, as I said, in Nefesh HaRav, Ein Makom HaHachmir Ulimno Mirachitza V'Tete Yamim. There is no reason to be machmir and refrain from washing. So this is another heter if you're looking for one. During the 9 days. And he says that if you want to be pious after Chatzos on Erev Tisha B'Av. This is from Moshe Soloveitchik. And when I was a camper in Camp Morasha, we're talking 1977, so a long time ago, the question always was what to do during the 9 days. Sure, everyone knows the famous custom. There's always two swims. There's instructional swim, and then there's free swim. So during the 9 days, you then have two instructional swims. By the way, this whole thing, because a free swim gives you pleasure, the whole idea is that that you can't have what they call rechitza shel tanug, washing yourself for cleanliness or for other reasons, for exercise, is not enjoyment. In theory, you could even wash yourself on Yom Kippur, and in theory, you could wash your whole body on Tisha B'Av. You take a shower, I guess. But since it's a very severe prohibition, and who's to say what the distinction is between tanug and getting, you might get all the dirt off you, and then for a second or 2 seconds, you'll find some enjoyment, you violated the prohibition. So we don't have any connection to water, to washing ourselves, other than if the hands are dirty after the bathroom or something on Tisha B'Av. But in Morasha, they called the Rav, and this is what the Rav said. This is a quote. He sent back that his grandfather, Rav Chaim, went swimming on the day before Tisha B'Av. Now, what does that mean, his grandfather went swimming? I think he was just trying to make a point. I don't believe his grandfather, there was a river there, but I don't think that's what he's trying to say. I think he was trying to say that his grandfather held, like Ramosha Soloveitchik, that there is absolutely no issue of bathing or washing yourself, even for pleasure, up until Tisha B'Av. Although, as he quotes Ramosha Soloveitchik in the Svarim, he's quoted Ramosha Soloveitchik, he quoted Rav Chaim also to Morasha, and therefore there was no reason for us, I don't know what they do today at Morasha, but there was no reason for us during the 9 days not to have free swim. I cannot remember what they did halacha l'maisa. I find it hard to believe that Morasha would have broken from what everyone else did. I'm sure they probably continued to go along having all instructional swim. But the fact is, they did call the Rav, and the Rav said that there was no need for this, that his grandfather went swimming or would go swimming the day before Tisha B'Av. So it's these sorts of ideas which come from the new way of analyzing Talmudic text that understandably would get the Ridvaz very upset. What else got the Ridvaz upset? Yeah, Rabbi Kelman, what you're saying is to clean yourself, there's no issue at all. But the, I'm sure you can get plenty of poskim will tell you even today during Shiva, technically you could wash yourself with hot water, but I think most people are machmir not to. But during the 9 days, this is considered it's not something special. For the same reason, showers on Yom Tov. I think it's become pretty standard now for people to take showers, hot showers, on Yom Tov, even though if you look at the classic sources, they speak against this. But today, showers is something we take for granted. It's not something special. Rabbi Broid has a long piece about that. And I'm not saying everyone follows this, but it's become pretty well accepted. And by the same token, you'll see people swimming. And religious people, they'll cool off in a pool, they'll go swimming on Yom Tov, things like that, for the same reason. Not in the ocean. The ocean would have the problem of building a boat. But I'm just talking about like a pool, and if you don't want to go swimming, at least just cooling yourself off if you're in Arizona. It goes back to the same idea. Now, the Ridvaz's criticism is also, I think, based on the fact, well, I know it's based on the fact that it's a new method. It's not traditional. But we spoke about other criticisms of the Brisker method. And this is one that, there's another one that the Ridvaz doesn't mention, but I think he probably had in mind, or it's implicit. What do you mean when you say it's not traditional? Well, traditionally we have a way of understanding what the Rishonim had in mind. However, Reb Chaim comes up with a method that wasn't practiced until his day, or at least they didn't think it was practiced. Reb Chaim would say this is the original method. But I said to you what his father said, that I was born before Matan Torah, before the giving of the Torah. The question is, does the Brisker method accurately reflect the historical Rambam? After all, what are we doing when we're studying Torah? We're trying to explain what the early authorities meant. We give an explanation. Most people understood, at least historically, most people understood it to mean that we're trying to offer an explanation that could have been said or was meant to be said by, let's say, the Rambam or the Ravid. So when we explain the Rambam, we think this is what he meant. However, can you say this about Reb Chaim's approach? This is Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg's great criticism. In my little book here, Studies of Maimonides and His Interpreters, I have a number of letters in the appendix from Reb Chaim of Weinberg, and he says over and over again that while Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is brilliant, his method is brilliant, he's a new Rambam, as it were, he says that his arguments and his explanations are true, but they're not historically true. What does that mean? It means that they're genius, but they're not historically true. The Rambam didn't mean this. And he mentions that we have response of the Rambam where they ask him about a difficulty, and he doesn't give Chefza Gavra or any analytic approach. He gives a simple answer. This is a great criticism of the Brisker method. If you look in Chakira in the journal, in the last, not the one that just came out 2 issues ago and 3 issues ago, you see what I wrote and the criticism of me. What is the Brisker method, the historical Rambam or not? And I think it's clear if you look at it, it's not the historical Rambam. That is, this is, if you want to know what the Rambam meant, you can't just look at the Rambam in a vacuum. This is what the Sridiyesha is speaking about. In yeshivas, they look in the Rambam in a vacuum. The Sephardic approach is very different. First of all, you have to read everything the Rambam wrote. You have to look at the Perush HaMishnah. You have to look at the Sefer Mitzvos. You have to look at the response of the Rambam, where the Rambam explains what he has in mind. Also, you need to look at the Rif. You need to look at the Gaonim. The Rambam is carrying on a tradition in these lands of the Gaonim, of the Rif. And then you need to look at the Rambam's students and his successors and the son of the Rambam, because they are carrying on the Rambam's tradition. The great criticism of the Brisker method, and I think it's valid, is that you take the Rambam and you remove him out of his historical context, out of his environment, and you just put him in your Beit Midrash and try to use him to come up with your explanations. But, and those are brilliant, and those are correct explanations, in the sense that they explain what's latent in the Rambam, but that doesn't mean they're historically correct. Now, Rav Lichtenstein has an essay in which he says that we're not interested in historically correct. That's not what we're at when we have Chidushim, Navelay. However, other people think very differently. They think that when you try to explain the Rambam and others, you are interested in historical and in original intent. So it's a great debate. So we've spoken about it before. I don't want to go into it in any more detail. Just to say that there's a real divergence here of when you study early authorities and you offer explanations, is it important for your explanation to be in line with original intent, or is it enough simply to be consistent with the words, but without there being any assumption that this is what the original person, the Rambam or Rashi or the like, had in mind? Rav Lichtenstein actually makes a distinction between practical halacha, halacha maaseh. He says, in that area, we should be interested in original intent. But when we're just coming up with chidushim, navelay, then we're not concerned with that. Truthfully, I think many people would disagree with Rav Lichtenstein. They don't. If the method is good, it's good for halacha, and it's good just for theoretical analysis. There's a sefer by Rabbi Greenspan, Nachman Greenspan. He was a rabbi in Leeds and then in London, and a very interesting rabbi. He says it's basic to the approach of Torah study. He's talking about the Ashkenazic world, that the explanations we offer are not in line with the original intent. And then there's other sources that speak about this. There's a famous Rav Yonason Eibschitz, after he gives an explanation, he says, is this what the Shulchan Aruch had in mind? And he says, no, it's not what the Shulchan Aruch had in mind, but divine providence has arranged things as such that we can come up with explanations that fit into the language and work with the language of the Shulchan Aruch, even if the Shulchan Aruch didn't have this in mind himself. It's very postmodern. If you think of the idea that an author does not have rights over his book, and we can offer explanations, and really without paying attention to what the author's historical context is and what he said, because a piece of writing assumes its own independent identity. And therefore, we're speaking at the Rambam, it's not the Rambam that we're studying, it's the Mishnah Torah. And therefore, there's one great example where the Rambam was asked a question, what he meant, and he gives an explanation. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik ignores the explanation and offers a different reason. It's even more than that. The Rambam says there's a mistake in the text, correct it. And Rav Chaim knew what the Rambam said because it's quoted in the Kesef Mishnah. I mean, some of the Tshuvot he might not have known. I developed this idea in my article on the Brisker method that the Rambam is only one explanation of the Mishnah Torah. And he's not necessarily the best. When the Rambam wrote his Tshuvot, you could say he was old, he forgot what he originally had in mind, and you can give all sorts of explanations. But Rabbi Weinberg doesn't buy any of them. Okay, let's go on. Rabbi Broid wrote about, if I recall correctly, you can email him, there was a journal that used to come out of England called Le'ela. And I believe it's in Le'ela that he wrote about that. It might be in his article on shaving during Chol Hamoed. He discusses about it, or it could be somewhere else, unless my memory is playing tricks with me, but I'm certain it's not. I'm not sure, Chaim, what you mean. He castigates the Maharshal. I mean, Maharshal, it's one thing to say that you can give an explanation on your own, but if that's what you're saying, but I'm talking about explaining the Rambam different than the Rambam himself explained it. Let's move on. By the way, Weinberg was also very annoyed because he asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, as he mentions this in his letters, who had a greater Havana, a greater understanding, the Vilna Gaon or Reb Chaim? And Rabbi Soloveitchik says Reb Chaim had a greater understanding even than the Vilna Gaon. The Rav himself got very annoyed. I mean, he was the greatest partisan of the Brisker Method, as we spoke about. He got very annoyed when someone mentioned the Ridbaz. I heard this from Rabbi Harlap. Once this person mentioned the Ridbaz, and then he mentioned him again, and the Rav went crazy, as the Rav go crazy in the 50s, really blew up at him. And the Rav said, and this is a quote, "Some Gedolim are always right." I guess that means Reb Chaim. "Some Gedolim are sometimes right, and some Gedolim are never right. And the Ridbaz was never right." And he said some other things. This goes back to the feeling of that the Ridbaz who attacked the Reb Chaim was really way out of line and had defamed the greatest Rosh Hashiva of modern times. Rav Zevin, in his book Sofrim Usparim, if you look in volume 1, it's page 53, you can find this, I don't know if it's on the Hebrew books, but it's on the Otzar Chachma, for those of you who have it. He repeats something he heard from an old-time rabbi in Jerusalem, that when the Ridbaz gave a shir, there was an old yeshiva called Toras Chaim in Jerusalem, he began by saying, quote, "I will not give you Torah dealing with the Chakira, the investigation. Is a man a man? Or is it that he is not a woman? And is a woman a woman? Or is that she is not a man? I'm going to talk traditional learning." But this is not incidentally Brisker. This is what they call Telzer. The Telzers would have all sorts of these investigations. And although the Ridbaz is without a doubt referring to Reb Chaim in his attack on the chemical method, he also attacked the Telzer method. Weinberg also speaks about it. He refers to this as a foolish Telzer Chakira. The specific case he was referring to was as follows. There's a Talmudic principle that if you're brought to court in a monetary dispute and you don't take an oath to clear your name, you have to pay. So the question was raised, how to understand this? Does it mean that essentially you're obligated to pay, but you can exempt yourself with an oath? Or does it mean essentially you're obligated to take an oath, but if you choose not to take an oath, you have to pay? And Weinberg called this a foolish Telzer Chakira analysis. He said it's no different than the following ridiculous analysis. Do we say that essentially John Doe is set to die and only if he eats he'll live? Or do we say that essentially John Doe is set to live and only if he chooses not to eat he'll die? It's always been a struggle to prevent true conceptual analysis from degenerating into these sorts of semantic games. The same thing happened with Pilpul, and if you look at Rabbi Unterman, his article in the Shimon Shkup Jubilee volume, he mentions that these sorts of extreme type of Pilpul analysis develop as a form of recreation. And the rabbis tolerated it because people were allowing their minds to wander. Although for many people it wasn't just a form of recreation, it became significant and a significant form of learning. Let's return to the story. We saw last class how the Ridbaz comes to Chicago. We spoke in great detail about his great disputes in Kashrus. Well, after 2 years in Chicago, he had had enough. His conflict with the Jewish Chicago gangsters had gotten to him. The Kashrus dispute was terrible. If you think the Kashrus disputes are bad today, you should look at what they were then. There's a story, I don't know if it's true, that he was locked up in a freezer. And he was able to get out. Someone opened it, and he thought his life was in danger. And on Friday night, he took his family on a train and went to New York. I don't know if it's true, but even if it's not true, it reflects the sense that he had to get out of there. It was so terrible. I did mention already, and I quote on the Sfarim blog, there is a true case of where one of these butchers locked the mashgiach in Washington, D.C., in the freezer. And Rabbi Gedalia Silverstone, who was the Rav of Washington, D.C., commented it might be the only time the butcher actually had kosher meat in his freezer. We've had all sorts of cases. I mentioned also the famous story of where at the Ramaz, his daughter's wedding, he was involved in the great kashrus disputes. The food was poisoned. And presumably this was done by some of the opposing butchers. Simon Glazer, who became an important rabbi in Montreal. Ira Robinson came out with a book last year dealing with the rabbin in Montreal. He was beaten up by by the Shochtim, who he opposed. In Paterson, New Jersey, a fistfight broke out between two different rabbis. And you have numerous cases like this where kashrus got this way. In any event, the Radbaz leaves. He comes to New York, and from there he decides to go to Eretz Yisrael and settles in Tzfat, Safed. But before he goes on Aliyah, he was in New York in 1904. And he was looking for something to do. And KJ, he left Jeshurun, one of the most important congregations in Manhattan, decides to hire him to preach on the high holidays. Remember, although the Radbaz had terrible problems in Chicago, in kashrus, and you had Rabbi Album and his followers who refused to accept the Radbaz, most of Chicago Jewry accepted the Radbaz. And as I said, the Agudas Rabbani of America declared him Zakein HaRabbanim, chief elder rabbi in America. So he was regarded as the most important rabbi. To get him to preach on the high holidays would be a very important thing. So they approached him. Now, who was the rabbi? Although he wasn't called a rabbi, he was called minister. If you go, by the way, to Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, to this day, the rabbi is called minister. But he didn't yet have smicha. He had graduated the Jewish Theological Seminary. Here he is, an early picture, Mordechai Kaplan. It's not that clear, this picture, but this is an early shot of him. He had graduated the seminary, so he had been given, which was then still a traditional institution, he had been given some sort of ordination, but it wasn't a traditional smicha. He later would then go to Europe, where he got smicha from Rav Rinus. But he was the functioning rabbi, as it were. He was the rabbi. Although they called him minister, but he was the rabbi of, but he was a Talmud Chacham Kaplan, as much as a Talmud Chacham as all these rabbis today, graduating certain yeshivas. But he didn't yet have a traditional European smicha. An American smicha wasn't good enough, so he was the minister. In terms of things recently in the news, we've spoken a good deal about women rabbis and everything. HIR now has a woman rabbi. Is Sarah Hurwitz. Her name, they call her Rabah, but that's a little foolish. In Israel, maybe you call them Rav, so in America, so in Hebrew, I guess you call Rabah, but she is a rabbi. Why is this significant? You're going to say, well, this is maybe an avant-garde shul. HIR is a member of the OU. And if HIR is a member of the OU in good standing, that means then that the OU, the Orthodox Union, accepts synagogues with female rabbis. And Rabbi Weiss, in his statement, said that she is a complete rabbi, a complete member of the rabbinic team, and she is a rabbi. So have we reached the point that we've spoken about? I have a piece that's coming out of Mark Angel's Journal in a couple months in which I say that we're on the cusp of Orthodox women rabbis. I think it's going to be outdated by the time it appears, because here you have a woman who passed the smicha exams that the men do, and she's now employed as a rabbi in an Orthodox synagogue, and if the OU permits this, that means that we've now reached a certain point. Of course, those who've been listening to me know, as I pointed out, the Chidah speaks of women rabbis a couple hundred years ago. Who would be hired shortly later? The Ramaz, or more, the one I mentioned before, Moshe Zulman Margulies. He is hired as the rabbi, and then he's the father-in-law of Joseph Holstein, and he becomes one of the most important rabbanim in America. And he was hired actually as an associate, as an assistant to Kaplan. But Kaplan is running the show, and they want to bring in the Radbaz. Well, the Radbaz says that he will not preach, he will not come to KJ and preach for the high holidays, if anyone, and that anyone means Kaplan, preaches in English. Kaplan preached in English. KJ was a modern shul. When I say modern, it was, you can read General Weissman Joselit's book, history, I forget the title now, which is really a study of KJ. He had German Orthodox, he had East European, he had all of them, but this was a shul of wealthier people. It was only later, it was only Rabbi Lichtenstein who got rid of the spittoons. So in that sense, it was still traditional. But this was a very fancy shul, and Mordechai Kaplan preached in English, not in Yiddish. Well, Yiddish was the native tongue for many of them. There's plenty of people born in America, Yiddish was not their native tongue, and this was an American shul. And Mordechai Kaplan was trying to bring Judaism to American Jews, so he preached in English. And Ridbaz says he will not go to enter any synagogue in which someone preaches in English. What's the problem with preaching in English? Don't all our shuls have preachers in English now? He saw this as a desecration of the synagogue. And he writes about this in the introduction to his Beit Ridbaz. I've said a number of times that one of the people listening to the class right now was very makbid. He holds to the Ridbaz. And every time the rabbi gets up to give a sermon, he feels he has to leave. Because he holds by the Ridbaz, and unless you're going to preach in Yiddish, which is almost impossible to find anymore, he leaves the shul. In this book, which is the Beit Ridbaz, as well as other writings put together by, organized by Mossad Rav Kook, that originally appeared early in the century, 20th century, but they reprinted all, he describes how preaching in the English language sermons, is the beginning of Reform Judaism. And let me read you what he says about this. He's not the first one to say this. He doesn't quote it. The Chassam Sofer, his ethical will, he says that after I'm gone, he tells this to his son, who's taking over his position, the Kassav Sofer, never appoint a preacher in the vernacular, only in Yiddish. And yet his own son, the Kassav Sofer, appointed a German preacher because he saw the times required it. Despite what his father said, none of the people could understand. In Pressburg, they reached a point where most people were German speakers, Hochdeutsch. It was part of the German cultural environment, and you needed to have a German preacher. That led to a terrible dispute in which he was attacked by Hillel Lichtenstein and others. And when we deal with, in future classes, with what happened in Hungary, one of the big things was German preachers. What are you supposed to do? If people are speaking German, what else can you preach to them in? The Maharam Shik was of two minds. He couldn't understand this decree. You're going to say that it's forbidden to preach in German, but since all the other rabbis were saying this, he said, I'm not going to protest. I'll go along with them. But he said something which, from our standpoint, makes perfect sense. It's not the language that matters, just like the Rambam said about the songs at a wedding. It's not the language. It's what you say in the language. But what does he say? This is on page 19 of the introduction. He says, the preacher, this is what he calls them, they stand on the bima in these synagogues and they say nonsense in English. They are the worst. They are destroying the tzmunah, the image of Judaism. And they even call them rabbi or reverend. And this is just like the priests do in their synagogue, in their churches. And he says, Be'ein Shem Hevdel, there's no difference between what these rabbis or reverends are doing when they preach in the vernacular and what these priests are doing in the churches. Because also the priests say words of Musar and Bein Adam Lechavero, even if it doesn't come from the Torah. And yet these rabbis, he calls them Rabbanim, Reish Ayin, you know, these evil sons, their drashot are not shy. They don't have anything to do with Kol Yisrael. They're turning Judaism into the religion of the Goyim. And if we do not get rid of this, these English language preaching, this will lead to Reform Judaism. Chas v'shalom. I find this almost incomprehensible for someone who had been in America, as he had been for a couple of years. It would be just the opposite. Not preaching in German, not preaching in English, would show the younger generation that traditional Judaism is something from the old-timers, something for the ghetto. But all the young people, it's the conservative rabbis and the Reform rabbis. The Reform rabbis would have liked nothing better than the traditional rabbis to only preach in Yiddish. That would be the perfect example. This is exactly what Hirsch realized. You have to preach in the language that the intellectuals speak, that the young people are speaking. Otherwise, Judaism becomes something of the past. But this was the Ridbaz's position. Ridbaz goes so far as to say that if you can't stop this practice, you have to leave the shul, as my friend does, when the English-speaking preacher gets up to deliver the sermon. Now, because of the Ridbaz's insistence, the synagogue, KJ, refused to allow Mordechai Kaplan to speak on the High Holidays. This was Kaplan's show, but the board obviously recognized that the Ritvaz is more important than Kaplan. They told Kaplan that, and Kaplan refused to preach. He discusses this in his diary. He refused to preach in any other language. He's not going to preach in Yiddish. He's an English-speaking preacher, and he thought this is very important. So the board refused to permit Kaplan to speak, because otherwise the Ritvaz wouldn't come. On Sukkot, by the time Sukkot came around, the Ritvaz was still in town. It wasn't just the High Holidays, it was Sukkot also. I think Kaplan probably feared he was being shut out. It's his own synagogue, and he's not doing anything. He agreed to preach, but not in Yiddish, only in Hebrew. So on Sukkot, Mordechai Kaplan's drushos were in Hebrew. It would have been a good Ashkenazic Hebrew. I don't think I'm going on too much of a limb to say that probably no one understood Kaplan's drushos, but the idea that he didn't have to preach in Yiddish, that to him, to preach in Yiddish would have violated his principles. So therefore, he preaches in Hebrew. No one understands what he's saying, but for that was okay for the Ritvaz. Hebrew's okay. English, it's not okay. Before we go further, I see someone points out, D, I think that's Rabbi Dovi Hoffman, who I mentioned a few times as a real expert on Rav Ovadia Yosef. Those who read the journal Or Torah can see his Torah articles, including this month. He points out correctly that there were Rav Ovadia Yosef also. Butchers tried to kill him. They tried to throw acid at him. There's a whole story about this in the biography. Returning to Kaplan, Mel Skolt has a biography of Mordechai Kaplan, and he discusses this incident in detail, and he quotes what the newspaper, The American Hebrew, says about this. The American Hebrew was a traditional paper opposing reform. I think we would call it an orthodox paper. And this is what it said about this event, this incident, where the synagogue decides that their own Rabbi Kaplan can't speak because they want the Ritvaz to come to town. It is a disgrace to the congregation, which permitted itself to be dominated by a man whose whole career in America has been that of a mischief maker. The sooner the Slutsker Rav gets out of America, the better. Kehilat Jeshurun should make reparation for the disgrace it has brought upon itself and the insult it has permitted to its preacher. Calling the Ritvaz a mischief maker, this goes back to what we said, that wherever he went, it created machokas. Now, but this is still from a traditional paper to attack the Ritvaz so strongly is significant. Obviously, Album attacks him much stronger, and other rabbis attacked him stronger, but this was in New York, where the Ritvaz really had a lot of support, and they thought, though, that it was a disgrace. Try to think in your own synagogues. High Holidays, that's the big time for the rabbis to speak. If, let's say, you're in your synagogue and a well-known rabbi is going to come for the yuntif, let's say he's your father-in-law or someone else, and the shul tells the rabbi, this Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you're not going to speak, rabbi. The visiting rabbi is going to speak, not just as a guest drasha, but he's going to give all the drashas, and you're not allowed to speak. I think every rabbi would take this as a terrible insult. After all, it's his shul, and he's being told he can't speak. This book, Beit Ritvaz, is also fascinating because of the introduction. I've mentioned that the Ritvaz's introductions are great. In the introduction, he speaks not just about America, he speaks about this is the situation of Jewish life in Lithuania, the problems, why Torah study declined. I'm going to write about this in a future Sforim blog, some of the things he deals with, other things. We have this sense, people like to think of the good old days, Lithuania, everything was so great, when of course the exact opposite is true, especially the early 20th century. But let me just summarize a few of the things he points out in this lengthy introduction, to give you a sense of the man and also the period. He talks about how in Hungary, we've spoken about the separatist communities in Hungary and Germany, where the Orthodox separated from the non-religious, the non-Orthodox. He says that in Lithuania, this never took off. The rabbis never cared about this. It didn't matter if the person was religious or not. They were part of one community. Rav Kook sees this as very significant, others as well. The Ritvaz says that this was a terrible thing. What this meant is that you had non-religious Jews involved in running of the city. I've spoken about how Bundists helped choose the rabbi of the shuls, of the community. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik had to deal with members of his community board who were not observant and all sorts of things. But this was the case in every city. This is also the case in Poland as well. So he speaks about how terrible this is. And then he tells an interesting story, how when he came to town, into Słutsk, he opened up, brought in people to teach Torah, and learning became a big deal. But then, after a few years, everything changed. I don't want to go through the whole story. He says that I've always been a kanai. I've always been a zealot. But none of the other rabbis want to go along with me. And in our own community, he talks about how from like 63 malamdim, I think he says, it went down to 3 malamdim, because the haskalah, he doesn't use the word haskalah, he says the new ideas come to town, and all of a sudden, many people are no longer religious, they don't feel the need to hire a malamid for their son, they don't need to send their kids to cheder. I mean, this is incredible. I'll read you the passage here. He says that in... in 1892, there were 62 malamdim, that is 62 people either teaching in a cheder or giving private lessons in the class, and he says that he would also organize the boys Friday night to study with him, and the Beis Medrash was full. And a few years later, you have people, he talks about, he mentions one person in particular who starts organizing people against the study of Torah. People begin to hate the study of Torah. Anytime they see someone who's Torato Unato, that's someone who's devoted himself to Torah study, they look down on him. They started speaking about the importance of having a secular education. What good is it if you have a Gemara? After all, this is the logic that only is used today. He quotes the Balabatim as saying, why are we wasting our time teaching our kids Gemara? They're not going to become Lamdanim. That is, they're not going to go away to the great yeshivas. It's not like today. Lots of people go to yeshiva. In those days, who went to yeshiva? 13, 14, you went to work. So why do you need to learn a Gemara and a Cheder? So you learn Gemara and Cheder from 10 to 13, and then you go out to work. Why waste your time? They were saying, learning Gemara, you're not going to become a Lamdan. It's a waste of time. And he goes on and on with that. He talks about how the shamashim, the shamases are no good. The rabbis are no good. He says that when he saw that the apikorsus, the heresy, got so great within only 2 years. I don't know if he's exaggerating. He says from 62 malamdin, it goes down to 3. He says, I had to leave Lithuania. And he continues talking about how terrible Lithuania is. How the rabbis don't stand up for Torah, and the people are not interested anymore. All they're interested is that their sons could have a decent profession, and they're not interested in learning anymore. He says that they would go around telling people, don't give your daughters to these bachrim. Anyone who studies in yeshiva, keep away from them, because what kind of husbands are they going to be, etc. They don't know how to make a living, all these things. And basically the Haskalah arguments against learning of Torah study. Terrible attacks on Jewish life, on what was going on in Lithuania. Then he goes on, and he says, smicha, what's the problem with all these rabbis? It was very easy to get smicha in Lithuania. Rav Yitzchak Hanan was known to get smicha very easily, and many other rabbis were. Shaul Lieberman, in his response about women rabbis, which he's opposed to it, incidentally, the great irony is that the left-wing Orthodox are more liberal on this matter than the right-wing conservatives. So the right-wing conservative, the UTJ and others, they're opposed to women's ordination, and the left-wing Orthodox are in support of it. It reminds me when the first women's prayer group, actually it wasn't the first, but it created the controversy in Queens, at Rabbi Krause's shul. The Queens Vada Rabbanim came out against it, they condemned it. The reason they condemned it and came out so strongly was because there was still a traditional conservative synagogue, I think it was in Forest Hills, and this old-time conservative rabbi was still fighting the battle against giving women aliyahs and egalitarianism. And when all of a sudden this women prayer group opened up and they're reading the Torah and all this, he approached the Orthodox rabbis and says, if you have Orthodox synagogues in which women are having all these roles, I'm not going to be able to hold the line in my synagogue. So the great irony is that the conservative rabbi is pressuring the Orthodox rabbis to stop another Orthodox shul from liberalizing the women's issue. But Shaul Lieberman, in that response, said that they would give smicha as a way of encouragement. It didn't mean that the person was a great lambda, that he sat for a few years in yeshiva, and Rabbi Weinberg mentions it. He says that people who couldn't get smicha in Berlin would go to Eastern Europe, and they would just be there for a short time, and they get smicha, and then they become rabbis. So he said this is in trying to defend the standards of the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, that we had higher standards, he says, than Eastern Europe. Ridvaz is using this to explain how it is that you have all these terrible rabbis who allow all sorts of terrible stuff, don't stand up for Torah. He's saying these are phony rabbis. These are rabbis who don't really know anything and shouldn't have smicha. And then he continues. Actually, I'm seeing we're out of time here. What we'll continue next time is his attack against the children of the rabbis. He goes so far as to say that the children of the rabbis are the worst heretics of all. And I'm going to tie this into what was going on at the very same time in the Hasidic world. And then, believe it or not, he becomes the great defender of America, how the Jews in America, or maybe are not the greatest scholars, but they're the real pious ones, not the Jews of Lithuania. A complete reversal of what he originally said when he came to America and said the stones, even the stones here, are impure. By the time he leaves America and goes to the land of Israel, he's judging the Jews of America on a much higher level than the Jews of Lithuania. I'll deal with this next class, and we'll also have to deal with one final issue, his great dispute with Rav Kook, not just over the sale of the Shemitah land, but also how to deal with the non-religious in the land of Israel. And that's what we will do next class. And we'll pick up, certainly next class, we'll begin with dealing with Rabbi Henkin. But now I see it's already 10 o'clock. Let's take time for some questions, comments. I'm sure there's some. I see D, that's Rabbi Dovi Hoffman, quotes Rabbi Vad Yosef as taking on Rabbi Chaim's interpretation of the Rambam. The Sephardic rabbis were never very impressed with Rav Chaim's interpretations because they didn't see it as in line with the pshat of the Rambam. What's significant is that Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg explains this, really gives the justification, the logic behind this rejection of Rav Chaim. And yet Rabbi Weinberg also says that he never went to meet Rav Chaim and study with him, and because of that he lost something that could never be replaced. So he sees the learning as incredible learning, but not really in terms of an explanation of the Rambam. Okay. See, I find it hard to believe that we don't have any comments or questions, so we'll stay on for a couple more minutes, see if anyone's writing in. How would the Rav know that Rav Chaim was greater than the Vilna Gaon? What's that based on? It's a good question you ask. In discussing this drasha of the Rav, it's his eulogy of the Brisker Rav, Rabbi Weinberg says that, I'll read the text, it's right here. I remember, he says, from reading this drasha, you get the sense that the Torah was not given through Moshe Rabbeinu, Chas V'Shalom, but through Rav Chaim. He says, Chas V'Shalom, let me read you the word. Says, I'll translate it. I've read the article of Rabbi Soloveitchik about his uncle. It's a wonderful language and the style, but the content is exaggerated, very exaggerated. This is how people of a kat, a sect, write, like Chabad and the Musar people. The Musar people were also part of a kat. They thought that they had the truth and no one else did. From this article, you get the impression that the Torah was not given by Moses, rather by Rav Chaim, Chalila. It's true that Rav Chaim put in a new approach of logical pilpul, but he says that this is not the historical Rambam. So you ask, how could Rav say that? Because they had a belief that the Torah study, studied by Rav Chaim, this approach of Torah study, was the highest level of Torah study imaginable. And the Vilna Gaon did not study in accordance to this level of Torah study. There's a great Rosh Hashiva in Israel, Rav Meir Mazuz. When he saw the book, which I published this in the Hebrew volume, he wrote to me that the way that we train our students at our yeshiva, Kisei Rachamim, in accordance with the Vilna Gaon, not with Reb Chaim. Precisely for what Rabbi Weinberg says, that this is not the historical Rambam. But the briskers think that this is, how to prove it? Of course you can't prove it. But they can look at the Vilna Gaon. What does the Vilna Gaon do? His explanations are more of a simple sort. And Reb Chaim is the one who has analytical brilliance. We don't see the Vilna Gaon writing commentaries like Reb Chaim does. So I don't think, incidentally, the Rav would have said this in his older years. Young people sometimes say things in the heat of the moment or due to family pride. If you recall Hirsch, his great criticisms of the Rambam, saying that the Rambam is really taking Aristotle and distorting Judaism, he said that in his first work, when he was 31 years old, the 19 letters. He never again repeated that criticism, because I think he recognized that it's not a lot of kavod with regard to the Rambam to say that. I would say the same thing about the Rav. I don't think the Rav in his 50s or 60s would say such a statement that Reb Chaim had a better understanding than the Vilna Gaon. But the Rav, when the Rav was in Berlin, what was he? He was in his late 20s. You can imagine someone with a great pride saying that. That's the only way I can explain. I have not heard any reaction from the OU or the RCA regarding the Rabba thing, Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz. What can they say? They can condemn the synagogue, like they condemned Rabbi Lichtenstein, but so they condemn the synagogue. They can, what does that mean? They're obviously not going to let this Rabbi Hurwitz, Sarah Hurwitz, into the RCA, although they probably will let her in. In fact, they definitely will let her into this group, the International Rabbinic Fellowship, which is the more liberal left-wing rabbinic organization. They're not going to expel Rabbi Weiss from the RCA. This is an important synagogue, HIR. I don't know what they're going to do. I'm sure they're having meetings right now. They're really between a rock and a hard place. If they try to do something, they're going to alienate many Jews, including important Jews. That synagogue has important Jews, people involved in the OU and others. And the shul still functions as an Orthodox shul. Some of you might recall my prediction. And I think this has proven me right, although we'll see, time will tell. I said that when they were having all these congressional interns, if you remember these so-called congressional interns, they couldn't call them rabbis, so they hired women to teach Torah classes and do everything a rabbi does. But Chas v'Shalom to call a rabbi. This was at Lincoln Square and others. They called them congressional interns. At the time, I said that if they just call the woman a rabbi, as long as the shul continues to function as an Orthodox shul halachically, that is, as a mechitza and everything, people will scream, but then they'll stop, and that'll be that. And people said, no, it's not true. Once they have an Orthodox female rabbi, the shul won't be considered Orthodox. People won't daven there anymore. So now we will have a test case to see if I'm right. I still believe that if a shul functions traditionally, halachically, that they can have a woman rabbi, and it will not affect the synagogue. And so far, I'm right. And I tell you, if Avi Weiss, Rabbi Avi Weiss, can do this without being attacked, without suffering any real consequences, then you'll start seeing this at other shuls. Let's not forget, there's this new yeshiva training women rabbis, so we'll begin to have female Orthodox rabbis. That is what's going to happen. This is obviously a real turning point. And what I say in my article in the Mark Angel journal is that when I was growing up, it's not just that it was unheard of. We knew, italicized the word knew, all of us knew, that it was impossible for there to be women rabbis in Orthodoxy. And yet we're seeing it happen before our eyes. Anyone else have any comments? We saw that Rav Uziel said you could have a woman posek. And at the time I mentioned that by definition a posek is a rabbi. Very few rabbis are poskim, but every posek is by definition a rabbi. So really, if Rav Uziel said you could have a woman posek, a woman dayan, he even said, if they want to justify it, the sources are all there. It's more of a sociological thing that's going to create the problems. Okay, you ask a good question, Yisrael, and the question was actually asked to the Hungarian rabbis, and they gave a very interesting answer. They said that the Rambam's Perusha Mishnah was not written in Arabic, that is the Arabic that the Arabs wrote. It was in Judeo-Arabic. It was written in Hebrew script, which meant it was written in a Jewish language. So it wasn't in the vernacular. when you give a drasha, though, in Hungarian or in German or in English, you're showing that Jews are part of the society. You're no longer a people apart. You're no longer separate. If you're giving it in Judeo-Arabic, then you're sort of, you're still separate. That was the explanation they gave. Other than the Ridbaz, I don't know of any Lithuanian rabbi, old-time Lithuanian rabbi, who had any problem. Maybe the Ridbaz was only here 2 years. That was his problem. But all the other great rabbis who came to America, many of them learned English and preached in English and gave sermons in English. All of the great rabbis in America who came from Europe thought it was vital for them and the rabbis they were training here to learn English to speak to the younger generation. This idea that in America you shouldn't preach in English, it's really an aberration. In Hungary, this was a philosophy. But for the Ridbaz to say it, as I mentioned, it's an aberration. No one agreed with him. Eisenstein, in his book, his autobiography, also deals with the Ridbaz and the Ridbaz's issues in New York. So I mention this as a curiosity, and because it shows his personality and his involvement with Mordechai Kaplan, but this was a real aberration. Later, you then have Hasidim who come to America, the Satmar, the Bubba, even Lubavitch, and for them, also, you don't preach in the vernacular. For Lubavitch, obviously, as they start going out on their outreach, you do preach in the vernacular, but in the Hasidic circles to this day, you'll never have a drasha in a Hasidic shul, in a traditional Hasidic shul, in anything other than Yiddish. But if you went to the Boston Rebbe shul, of course he gave his drushas in English. I don't know what the Boston shul does in Brooklyn. There's a Boston shul in Brooklyn. I don't know what they do, but the Boston Rebbe always gave his drushas in English, and you can't fight progress. It's like the Ridbaz fighting against English sermons is like these rabbis fighting against the internet. It was Judeo-Arabic. They didn't speak Judeo-Arabic. Well, they spoke Arabic. The written language was Judeo-Arabic. Obviously, the Arabic the Jews spoke had Jewish terms, but it was Arabic. But the written language was nothing that the non-Jew could read. So it showed the separateness. All the Jews, all the commentaries that were written, and it's not just the Fachya. Yehuda Levi also, the Kuzari was written in Arabic, and Munah Ramah of Avram Ibn the Raivad the First, and the other great works from the Spanish era and from the Arabic lands were also written in Arabic, many of them. Okay, anyone else has anything? If not, we will pick up next week. I have a good deal more to get to. Those who sent me things, emails, I'll try to get to them, not to fear. I see Rabbi Dovi Hoffman's on, as I said, so I'll try next class at the beginning to quote to you what Rav Soloveitchik says about the Brisker method and the idea that practical halacha versus theoretical halacha. I have some new stuff, interesting stuff about Rav Avadya Yosef. Lots more to do. I look forward to another great semester. Hear from all of you, good comments, and until next week, everyone should enjoy themselves. Okay, you have something to say, Rabbi Kelman?
No, just have a good night. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you all again, and see you next week.